Major David Katz, welcome back from Spain.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How was it? Great to be here.
No, it was fantastic. The weather.
Yes.
I think it was 37 or 38 degrees in the shade.
I feel like you're showing off now. And you've actually got taller. You've actually grown while you were away.
I have. I think it's all the walking I did around Barcelona and Madrid and that type of thing.
Gave me
a bit of height. Yeah.
Yeah, it does give you height. How many steps a day?
I think our record was 20, I don't want to boast, but I think, it was 27,000, the record. That translates to 16 kilometers or something. So
amazing.
We walked
you
the city
walk
flat.
And walk.
It was
Barcelona is just the most amazing city. I stayed once there at the Art Hotel, very Art Deco, very, very different, modern. Mm. And I think it's where they had the Olympics, that area.
I walked that area.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful. And I think
if I was running at the time, I would have loved to run there.
Are you running now?
No, I'm tapering.
lots of runners there.
Yeah,
I mean, you would have fitted in like a glove. You know what I'm saying? No, there's a lot of people running all over the place here. Museums, the art museums, just
incredible.
Museums are just incredible all over.
Yeah.
And we did a Gaudi sort of a tour. We went to all of Gaudi's buildings and, his stuff
incredible.
Is just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And we went to that park. With these buildings and, what a brilliant trip there.
Absolutely amazing. Welcome back. And as always, travel is just the most incredible thing, broadening your horizons completely. All right. So tell us, what are we talking about today in the world of military? Because this is Military Monday after all.
Well, a lot's happened in the few weeks that I've been gone.
Yes, that's true.
Certainly the situation seems to, there's a lot more friction going on. All over the world, things are ramped up. You know what strikes me, also being a little bit away, you get a bit more perspective, is that there seems to be on the part of the USA, there seems to be very little coherent strategy. I don't know if you're feeling the same. Usually you sort of know where a country's going, you know, where its foreign policy is going.
It just really is a war of words. Because we laugh about it here because every morning we look at what happened in the world whilst you were sleeping. And one of the papers, it's Israel National News, every single day has, one day has a quote by Iran, one day has a quote by Donald Trump, one day has a, and it's just the silliness. We'll bomb you, no, we'll bomb you first, no, we'll wipe you out in 30 minutes, well, we only need 25. You know, it's like that sort of
thing. Starts off with this puerile texting.
Yes, exactly.
And then it sort of develops from there, and then it seems that the USA backtracks on taking it to the brink. Never sort of takes it there, backtracks on taking it to the brink, and I just don't know where it's leading.
Right. So where do you think it's leading?
I can't say. I mean, as I say, there seems to be no consistent plan.
Right. And how real is the threat of Iran? You know, they're now talking about obviously enriching uranium, and which probably means they aren't yet a nuclear power.
It's a good question, and we've discussed this. Is Iran a conventional threat? We've seen over the last couple of weeks some of the shipping in those shipping lanes, which is the center of the oil supply. We've seen some of the shipping being attacked,
right.
which alarmed the world. I don't know if oil is so central to everybody's strategy anymore, seeing that the States is self-sufficient and most of Europe is self-sufficient. So we've seen some...
I would think that the whole oil thing is more about strangling Iran than it is about oil supply.
Certainly that's changed, and it seems to be that. So is there a massive oil threat like there was in 1973? I doubt it. I don't think that's what the problem is. Mm. Does Iran pose a conventional threat to the United States of America? Certainly not. I mean, we both have discussed it. We've seen that Iran is not going to last past a couple of weeks on the conventional front. So it doesn't really pose a conventional threat. Does it pose a nuclear threat? Are they anywhere near to producing a nuclear bomb? Would it be allowed? Also doubtful. So I don't know. I think that they pose a non-conventional threat in backing all these different types of movements in the Middle East, these destabilizing movements. That's where the problem comes in. And also, they're a point where the two sides oppose each other through proxies. So you've got the Russians and the Turkish backing Iran, with the Chinese throwing their lot in against the United States and Israel and the other people coming in behind them. So it seems to be a focal point of where There's a gathering of different interest groups. That's where the problem lies at the end of the day, is that it may lead to a problem between one of the nations backing, the two on the opposing sides backing.
But not a direct conflict between the US and Iran.
I don't see it, because the US keeps on taking a backtrack also. They take it to the brink. They're trying to use threatening moves to change Iran's policy. I don't know if that's going to work. It hasn't worked in the past. And every single time we come to the brink, they seem to backtrack. And I don't know if that's helping at all. I think that's emboldening the Iranians also.
I mean, you had that when they shot down an unmanned drone that was flying over Iran. The United States apparently being literally 10 minutes away from launching an attack, and then it just didn't happen.
Even stating it, Howard, to say, you know what, we were 10 minutes away and then we backtracked on it, gives away too much information. Showing them that they backtracked for some reason. What was the reason that they backtracked? It certainly was a victory for Iran, I think, on the political front. It emboldens them. So I don't know quite where that's going. We'll have to see. As I say, there's no coherent policy that we can follow. I just don't know what the end game is on this whole thing and where we're going with it. And it's the same types of policies also towards North Korea. I don't know how you felt about it. I missed what you said about it. The meeting between Trump and the North Korean dictator.
So I thought it was very, very interesting, in the sense that I think Trump took an incredible, incredible risk. The risk not being that he was going to be shot when he walked into the demilitarized zone.
The risk that the invitation would have not been accepted.
Well, it was accepted, but the risk that the guy wouldn't pitch.
Yes.
And he knows, North Korea is smart enough to understand that if he stands Trump up, it'll totally destroy him. The Trump's own media in America would have seen him as being incredibly, incredibly weak, as a failure. He would have become the laughing stock of anybody who doesn't like the man. So, he took an enormous, enormous risk by walking out first to that demilitarized zone before he knew that Kim Jong-un was even going to arrive. So I think it was an incredible risk. And
to achieve what end? That's what I'd like to know. What did it?
Yeah, I don't know what he achieved. I think he achieved on some level, but I mean, it's only for people who support him anyway, that look what he did. He's the first guy to have walked into, you know, and then all the memes of Obama hiding behind a barrier with the binoculars, but Trump out there in the front. So I think it achieved that for him personally, that he's prepared to he's brave, he's not hiding. But whether it achieved anything for the peace talks, I'm not sure, especially considering 3 days later.
3 days later there was an issue.
There was already an issue. But I think that is how this is going to be. It's a few steps forward and a few steps back. I think it's the North Koreans are incredibly skittish. You know, you see that in their body language every time they meet. Mm. There's almost this need to reassure Kim Jong-un and bring him slowly. It's like this guy's, I think, severely paranoid. So he gets to a certain point and he believes, and then something in his brain says, these are still Americans and we know what they're about. It's like he's been indoctrinated in this way of thinking that he can't seem to get out of. So I think this is a process, but I think it's a better process than not talking, surely.
I think it's pretty debatable. I mean, you're raising the stature of somebody who maybe doesn't deserve for his stature to be raised.
Well, it depends what the end game is. If the end game is to try and have some kind of global peace, then so what if you're raising this?
But I mean, is it possible to have a global peace with a despot like this from North Korea? I mean, is he even worth negotiating with? I mean, is it not just a question of really trying to get a regime change? And which he, I think, fully understands that if he gives up any decent ground on this, that there is going to be a regime change. That is what he's worried about. The only thing that's keeping him going is the iron fist that he rules his country with, and the threat of the nuclear weapons that he has. And I mean, he's certainly not going to give, those are the two cornerstones of his power. Is he going to give up on his the nuclear? Once that's gone, his stature within his own country disappears.
Right.
And that's what's giving him this international stature, is the nuclear weapons. So is he ever going to willingly give these things up? What can the USA offer him that's going to make him give up these weapons and become a Democrat?
Well, I wouldn't. I wouldn't mean, is that go. Possible? I wouldn't go so far. Jonathan says, referring to Iran, he says it wasn't a complete failure for the U.S. They launched a successful cyber attack on their military instead of a conventional warfare. I'd love your thoughts. 34519 or 0618951019. It is 8:22. I'm Howard Feldman, chatting to Major David Katz. This is Military Monday, and we're talking about some of the bigger conflicts around the world. Time is 8:30. Major David Katz joining us in studio, and we're talking about the world's largest, larger conflict. Tell us what you thought of the G20.
Well, that's very interesting. Putin announced the end of Western liberalism, which is which I think just about sums up what's happening under Trump's government, is that America's becoming more isolationist. The whole idea of exporting American Western liberalism to the rest of the world seems to be taken a back foot as the USA becomes more isolationist. Nationalism is on the rise. Populism is on the rise. And people and governments seem to be withdrawing back into themselves. And I don't think he's 100% wrong. Don't know where it's going to end up. But I think he put his finger on it, and he seems to be quite gleeful about the whole situation, as if he's had a hand in it. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. I think in certain places he has had a hand in it. I wonder how much hand he's had in Brexit, and we know all about the American his involvement in the American elections. And so how far is the Russian hand in dismantling what the West has been all about over the last half century? So that's very, very interesting, and an interesting development over there. Don't know how you feel about it. Help me unravel that one.
Yeah, it's a very strange one, because the G20 was a very interesting combination of all sorts of leaders getting together, and you saw that Theresa May and Putin was appalling. They absolutely detest each other. Yep. You see Donald Trump and Putin getting closer together. You see North Korea and both of them trying to pull close. So it was a very, very interesting example of where I think personal relationships define national relationships.
That's an interesting point.
Because when Donald Trump is joking and saying to Putin, "Don't interfere with my elections," and they both laugh.
He's minimalizing what the issue is all about.
Exactly,
no,
and that's about
really
their own relationship.
Yes. But can you conduct a foreign policy on a personal relationship? So surely it's part of it to have some type of rapport. But at a strategic level, can you really conduct a foreign policy based on your personal feelings about who you're conducting the foreign policy with? I don't think that's any type of foreign policy.
Yeah,
and this is what we've come down to. Do we like the leader, or don't we like the leader? And therefore that defines where the country's foreign policy is going. That's crazy stuff, I think, at the end of the day. I can't get my head around it. Take a look at the situation in Iran, for instance. You've got the Russians backing the Iranians. You've got the Americans backing the Israelis. You've got the Israelis and the Russians having a fantastic relationship and really ignoring each other's participation against the Iranians. So that's an incredible situation. And, it's just a crazy foreign policy. There doesn't seem to be, you can't get your head around. There's no direction that you can get, that you can grab onto. And, certain people are able to swim in these type of waters, these confused type of waters where you don't really know where the direction is going. But I think it's going to lead to a problem.
In what way do you think it's going to lead to a problem?
Well, it's going to have to consolidate at some point. People are going to have to nail their colors to the mast. And it's going to be interesting to see how it stacks up. Let me give you a scenario. What happens if Jeremy Corbyn comes in as the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom,
right,
and Trump doesn't win the elections? Where does that leave Israel? That's an interesting one. I mean, the Israelis have sort of nailed their colors to the mast with Trump, and they've doubled down on him on many, many occasions. What happens now if those...
Well, I think the first thing you have to look at, you've got to split it. You can't just look at it like that. You've got to look at it and say, well, if Donald Trump doesn't win the elections and Joe Biden does, what is likely to happen in America with regard? I think America is still largely very supportive of Israel. I think you've got pockets of of extreme groups within the Democratic Party that are not, is not supportive of Israel. And I think the Democrats have their own issues that they have to contend with. So I think they might, I certainly think it'll cool the relationship, and I think it'll put more pressure on it, but I don't think that it'll go from 100 or 95 down to 1%.
And certainly the Israelis are going to have a more difficult time under democratic governments.
No question, also, as they always have
That the Israelis have participated so strongly on the Republican side, with Bibi addressing the Congress, coming out for the Republicans against Obama, backing Trump now to the hilt, Trump backing them to the hilt. They've nailed their colors to their mast, so they're going to have a difficult time dealing with some type of other leadership. And the same goes for the UK. It's as I say to you. What is the end result? The end result is that it all goes well while these people retain their office. Once these people are no longer in office, where does it go to from there? That's interesting. And what is the next president of the United States going to look like, given the way Trump is changing the very stature of the office that he's in now, and he's changing the ground rules also.
Right. Well, to some extent, what's happening in the United States in politics and everywhere around the world reflects where the world has gone. We are people of extremes. We do sit on either side of it. No one's really in the middle. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a middle measure. Obama was a peace-loving left-wing associated president, to the point that there was a perception of weakness, and I think in many ways the perception was correct. There wasn't a red line just move. So, and I always think of him as being the Hamlet of American politics, because he just didn't make a decision. But then the reaction to him is Donald Trump. Now, what happens the next time round? Do we get an AOC, coming in? Because does it flip the other way? And you're seeing the same thing happening in the United Kingdom. If Jeremy Corbyn becomes prime minister, it's a reaction as well to this type of thing. So what happens in America might actually have an impact on which way the United Kingdom goes. So everything is either very far right or very far left. And, we like that on social media. We like that in our opinions and everything. There doesn't seem to be, we're fast living in a world that is obliterating nuance.
Yes, I agree with that. But
and our politics reflects that.
I think there's another movement at foot here, and I'm not so sure if it's a battle between the right and the left. I don't know if Trump really represents the right. I think the right back him, but I don't know if he presents the right. I think something else is afoot over here. In that we were looking previously at governments run by an elite, basically. Can we call it a meritocracy in certain cases? Okay. I mean, many, many years ago we had that. And governments, it's been run by some type of elitism, which has now changed. Trump is not an elitist. He's been elected by people who never really had a voice before. Blue-collar workers, guys living out in the rural areas, people that have felt marginalized by the elite and big business previously, and who never thought they had any power whatsoever, now realize that they have power. They've voted a man in that supposedly represents their beliefs at the end of the day. And now people like the Democrats, who are pretty elitist, have lost a lot of ground because these people feel empowered. They feel that they vote. A lot of Americans never went out and voted because they felt they were powerless. Now, all of a sudden, these very people that put Trump in feel that they have the power to put people that will represent them into government, and Trump is one of those type of people. So this is what's happening all over the world, basically, is that people who felt pretty disempowered before, not necessarily elite, not necessarily the highly educated, but blue-collar, ordinary people now are coming out and feel they have a voice. And that's something that's changing worldwide.
Peter wants to know, what does Major Katz make of the seizing of the tanker carrying Iranian oil through European waters of the Strait of Gibraltar? It didn't dock in Europe. Was it legally seized? Can Egypt seize cargo going through the Suez Canal where it embargoes a country? It was legally seized, as far as I understand.
I think it was legally seized. What's interesting about it?
That was the one on the way to Syria, actually.
Yes, it was seized. What's interesting about about that? Is the Europeans now getting involved against the Iranians, trying to hold that whole deal together and salvage it, but in the meantime actually having to fall in line with the whole US policy and blocking some of the Iranian shipments. So they've been forced to align themselves in one way with the USA, and on the other hand they're trying to retrieve an irretrievable situation with Iran and keep that deal going. So that's with the USA pulling out of that deal, that's torpedoed the European initiative behind this whole thing. So they're also going to have to make some type of decision, because the Iranians in reaction to the US are now breaking the agreement by enriching more uranium, which is forcing the Europeans to take some type of action. So that's also an interesting development.
Time is 8:40. I'm Howard Feldman chatting to Major David Katz. We're talking Military Monday.